The Shining Wizards Network proudly present the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast with your hosts, the Impact Playa, Mr. Phil Rea, and Dave Mega Powers, exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. And now, here they are, Phil and Dave, your new symbol of excellence in sports entertainment broadcasting, the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. All right, Shining Wizards is the network. The Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast is the show. This is episode number 31. I, of course, as always, your gracious host, the Impact Player, Mr. Phil Rea, and I am always now joined by
the Mega Powers.
Nice. Dave is back in the fold. This is the follow-up to the big anniversary show. We are back in the fold. Summer is moving quite well, actually quite warm here if you're in the Northeast, but just getting over a heat wave. But Dave, how's it been, brother?
It's been going good, man. I've been pretty busy, as we all know, because what was the last show that we had, like a few weeks ago? So.
Yeah, we're trying to do this every 2 weeks, but Dave was tied up with some other stuff that he's trying to get going. And you listen, you can't knock another man's hustle, you know? My dad always said that, and you know, you gotta take care of business before pleasure. That's how we roll here in the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. But the network is getting rave reviews. I want to say a big shout out and a very big thank you to the Midnight Jury, Mike and Adam, who are plugging the shit out of our show on their last podcast. If you didn't get a chance to listen, Dave, it's really good stuff. They do a lot of pop culture, horror movies, and of course they do wrestling. So shout out to them. Shout out to Central Philly. Those guys are really cool. Of course, Tim Mayfield was on their show too the other day. It was really good. They talked about the Halloween Rob Zombie thing, and they covered some old school WCW wrestling, and then plugged the Shadow Network, which is pretty cool. Just Incredible Stuff is doing well. The Wizards had a nice follow-up. They had Mantar on their show the other day. I don't know if you heard it.
I got to hear that. I've had no time to do anything, and there's like all this amazing stuff that I'm missing out on, so I have a lot to catch up on.
Well, that's the cool thing about the crappy commute that I have, because what I do is now I download all these things to my phone, and I just, you know, at my leisure, just plug them in. So the network's doing big things, man. Check us out, swn.shiningwizards.com. And speaking of networks, my friend, you have not been in the loop. I need to tell you about a couple of things. The Throwbacks got picked up by The Rant, which is it actually, you go to therantradio.com, T-H-E-R-A-N-T radio, therantradio.com, part of the Rantum Network. I want to thank our pal Double A and those guys. We are in their rotation. They normally do like a live show network, but since we don't go live, our show is in their rotation now.
This has been pre-taped 6 months ahead.
But Double A and all those guys were gracious enough to pick us up, and they like our show, so I want to thank them. If you want to listen to any of their shows, go to therantradio.com, rant them on radio on Twitter, and also if you want to listen to them on your smartphone, Android device, download the TuneIn, that's T-U-N-E-N, app, and you can just type in Rantum Radio, and our show is on there, actually last night when I came back from all my festivities. So we're doing big things, Dave. Big, big things.
Huge.
All right. So today, episode 31 is it's a summer themed topic, but I didn't realize it was in July of 1984 until I actually was watching the actual clip. Now you did see the whole clip, well, I hope.
Yeah, I watched the whole thing. We're 2 days away from the anniversary.
The 29th anniversary. Now, how old were you in 1984?
I was 0 years old, so wait, no. I was born in January, so this is July, so I was 7 months old.
Unbelievable. I was a very, very excited 9-year-old. This was like my first... See, this was like the paint the scene. This was the MTV era. This was the infancy of Hulkamania. Hulk Hogan was only champ maybe a year at this point.
No, he started in January of 84, yeah.
Was it 84 or 83? Oh, no, you're right. He's only been champion for seven months.
I think that was on the 23rd as well.
Of January. So this is actually the seven-month anniversary of Hulkamania. Hulkamania
Absolutely.
Is in its... Thank you for correcting me. Hulkamania and Mega Powers are in their infancy.
Yes.
And this is a big deal. This was the brawl to end it all, okay? If you were lucky enough to have cable, none of us here were not. If you lived out east or in some other suburb, New York City did not have cable. This was on the Madison Square Garden Network, and this is actually where I got the clip from the YouTube feed.
Yeah, now, when you told me about this, I thought it was the war to settle the score, but apparently there was a brawl to end it all. Like, I hadn't... And I'm a big fan of particularly like this era of WWF, so I'm kind of surprised that this one slipped by me.
Nah, you know what? I'm glad I found it. This is the prelude to the war to settle the score, and I didn't realize it until I watched the main event, and I went back and looked at the Wikipedia. I'm like, wait a minute, this was the brawl to end it all. This was the
apparently the brawl to end it all could not finish things because they had to have a war to settle the score.
Well, the card is, I mean, for the time now, mind you, this is 1984, dude. So the card is stacked.
Yeah.
You had 10 matches plus a battle royal, which we'll get into. A couple of things I did not know, and we'll get into that in a little while. But this was the show was a major event leading to, like I said, the Rock and Wrestling Connection. And this was the first time I think I've ever realized that a women's match was the main event.
Hulk Hogan. Yeah, the last time that I remember a women's like title match being absolutely significant was Lita against Trish Stratus on a Raw a while back. Like that was the last time I remember. Besides this, of course.
Right. So now,
a women's title match being the main event.
Right. So every championship was defended. If you look at some of the Wikipedia, which I guess I don't know how, you know, of course it's Wikipedia, so the fans are in charge of all that. But according to some sources, only the main event was televised in certain places. So you didn't get the entire card unless you had like cable television.
Yeah, it seemed like there was like an MTV like special on this, and that was the one match
right.
that they showed.
Right. So
the rest of this stuff was just showcased on MSG Network if you were lucky to be in the area and have MSG and
right.
watch all these great house shows.
Absolutely. Now, MTV aired that. Around this time, Cyndi Lauper was the hottest thing going in music. Queens native, great, great performer. She's so unusual, made Billboard chart records at the time. Almost every song on that album was a success. And her video for Girls Just Want to Have Fun featured Captain Louis Albano. So this was the prelude to that. This was the hype after that. He played the angry dad in the video, the sexist dad, can't go out, can't have fun. He was like, he's an old man, he was a prude, you know?
Yeah, and that's kind of what led up into this this feud that they had in the WWF. Because I don't recall if it was a Piper's Pit or what, but the whole basis of it was that Lou Albano was saying that he was the sole reason for Cyndi Lauper's success, which brought about the feud between Richter and Fabulous Moolah.
Right, right. So, with that being said, this is the brawl to end it all. July 23rd, 1984, Madison Square Garden, 15,000 plus. Your commentators are Gorilla Monsoon and Mean Gene Okerlund. Of course, your ring announcer, as always, was the Fink Howard Finkel. All right. Your opening contest was Samoan number 2, which was Sika,
yes.
against Big Ron Shaw.
Ron Shaw. What can be said about Ron Shaw? Probably nothing. But
well, Ron Shaw was a 6'5". Well, they didn't call him. They called them preliminary guys back then, but now we call them jobbers. The political term now. What is it? Enhancement talent. Is that what they call
them?
Yeah,
that's okay. What Barry Horowitz would all have a saying at the right now.
Right now, Ron Shaw was about 6'5", big dude. He was also sometimes the masked executioner. So if you ever saw any old WWF clips on television or Wrestling Challenge or Superstars with the masked superstar, it was Ron Shaw. It was just a journeyman, nothing more, nothing less.
Now I remember an executioner who was also masked, but I don't remember a masked executioner.
Yeah, no, that executioner, I believe, was
Buddy Rose.
Yes, it was. It was Playboy Buddy Rose. Yes, Playboy Buddy Rose. All right, so now, Dave, right after we posted this particular card that you and I were going to go over, you and I like to do this Facebook thing back and forth, you actually posted something about the Samoan lineage. Why don't you get into that for like a split second?
Oh, my God.
No, I'm not saying read the whole thing. I'm just saying, like, get into how you found it, what would intrigue you to do it?
Yeah, I was actually watching this, and I was like, you know, there's a shitload of Samoans. Like, I need to really, you know, immerse myself. Because, like, at this point in time, what was it, the Wild Samoans, they already won the tag titles. They had it for, you know, how many months? Like, 6 months or so.
Right.
And, you know, they were kind of, like, on the downturn at this point. They were just kind of floating around. There wasn't really too much going for them as, you know, a lot of tag teams were the tag teams from the 70s were starting to phase out.
Right.
But, you know, of course they produced so many, like, greats, like the Head Shrinkers, Samu and Fatu. Samu was actually a part of this event as well, if you remember him.
Yes, we'll get into that. That was the last match, actually.
But how many people? I'm pulling this up right now. Like, it's like unfathomable amount of talent that is coming out of this family. Like, over 20 wrestlers here. Rikishi, the Usos, the Tonga Kid, Rosie, Yokozuna, Black Pearl, Manu, L.A. Smooth, The Rock, Peter Maivia, the Rocky Johnson. You know, good Lord. How many, like, this is probably, like, one of the biggest wrestling families out there, you know?
Yes.
Forget about the Hart family. Forget about
the Von Erichs.
The Guerreros, all that. This is, like, an insane amount of people talent that's come out of one family.
The Samoan lineage runs pretty deep, and I'm glad you posted that because they still have an impact today. Rikishi's kids are, you know, a mainstay now as a tag team. Afa and Sika run one of the best schools in the Northeast or the East Coast period. And, you know, this is going to be going on for a long time. Tamina Snuka's daughter, still wrestling, has a part in the new Hercules movie with The Rock, who's a cousin, who's also a Samoan. It goes on and on and on, like you said. There's a whole bunch of, you know.
I want to throw this out there because this one just totally bypassed me. But Gary Albright was a part of that family, too.
Was he really?
Yeah, because he was married to Offa's daughter.
Unbelievable, man.
So technically, kind of like a Jim Neidhart kind of deal, Gary Albright is technically a part of the Inoue family.
Right, yeah. Well, same thing with Rocky Johnson. He married the daughter of the High Chief, Peter Maivia.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it goes on and on and on. So Ron Shaw fighting Samoan number two, which was Sika. Funny thing though, while they were showing the match, they had the clip was from WWE Classics on Demand, and they showed an old school flashback clip that on that day, the 23rd Summer Olympics opened in Los Angeles, and I was like, oh man, I feel terrible. I feel so old right now. It's just terrible. But yeah, Sika, I mean, it was a decent match. Again, this is 1984, so. Sika does hit Shaw with a dropping headbutt.
Yeah, and one of the things that I found interesting, like while watching this match, was they were even then they were still playing up the whole thick headedness, like the extra thick skulls of Samoans. Now I've yet to do like an X-ray on a Samoan person, but it's amazing how I don't recall offhand like what was going on, but. Yeah, it was the headbutts. He was like Shaw was headbutting Sika, and the guy was just no selling it. And for me, I've been headbutted several times in the past. it's not a good feeling. I've had times where I've headbutted somebody so hard, like I started bleeding. So the fact that these guys are just trading headbutts, you know, whether you know they're putting like the palm in front of the forehead or not, but. The headbutt is not a fun move to perform or something to show off with.
Right. If I can quote my friend John Episcopo, Samoans are actually Mexicans that can swim. That's his quote, not mine. But Sika hits Shaw with the dropping headbutt for the win. I want to say about the 6 minute mark. So
with these cards, especially at this time, like. You know, it was really centered around, like, the main matches. You know, there was a lot of enhancement matches that followed onto, like, huger things. So this was, you know, something to warm people up. It wasn't really anything to...
Yeah, curtain jerker. Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, so the next match was the Iron Sheik defeating Tony Garea. Sheik had just lost the belt again 7 months prior. This was a really rough time for the United States as we were at war with, I believe, Iran.
Yeah.
That was just right during the hostage crisis and all that nonsense.
Which is why Freddie Blassie was going under the moniker of the Ayatollah.
The Ayatollah, I had that in my notes, too. And then Mean Gene, of course, pointing out that politics and sports don't mix. And how do they let this man in the WWF is beyond me, he says. Again, Sheik, the former World Wrestling Federation champion, former tag team champion. But Tony Garea himself, a former five-time tag team champion in his own right.
Yeah, this was also, like, you know, a downslide for Garea. You know, the guy held tag titles with who? Like, Rick Martel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Didn't he hold one with, like, Ivan Putski, too?
Yeah, he's actually, Garea is my age now. At that time, he was almost 39 years old. And, of course, Monsoon says famously, that doesn't happen by accident, all those championships, you know?
He's one of many people on this card who, as a good friend of mine will call them, the men in suits who would come out during, like, a lot of the brawls and, you know, miscarriages of justice that were happening after matches. And you know, you would have these guys running out in suits who were the road agents.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't know who the hell these guys were. And Tony Garea is one of the few people on this card who would be one of the men in suits later on in the 80s and 90s.
Yep, another guy on this card, too, Rene Goulet, was another road agent for them. So...
to say on him later on. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, of course, the Sheik has so much heat from the audience, from the crowd. Oh, the Garden crowds, like I told you in the first couple of shows we did together, the Garden crowd was always hot, always hot. Chants of USA, Sheik eggs him on. Garea actually looked great in this match, believe it or not. You know.
Yeah, well, both of them were still, like, in great form, and, you know, Garea was still being used, the Sheik, you know, even though he lost the title, he was still, like, hot and heavy with Hogan going back and forth with rematches.
Yep.
And, oh my god, I always heard about this one from the Meadowlands where I think he, like, brings, like, the flag into the ring and he starts ripping it up. Like, I wish there was footage of that. I would love to see that match, but... No doubt the Sheik was still a major threat in the WWF at this point.
Yeah. So now how this went was, now Gorilla, of course, Gorilla Monsoon, stating that the Sheik's boots are loaded, as Sheik puts the boots to Garea. But here's the thing. The finish on this was like just a regular finish. I mean, not a regular finish, but like just a regular wrestling move now. That was a finishing move back then, which is beyond me. Sheik hits like a reverse, throwing Garea frontwards into the turnbuckles in the corner, and then as Garea's backing out, hits him with a back suplex for the win.
Yeah. This was surprisingly like a really clean match for the Sheik, you know, despite the loaded boots. You know, but yeah, this was a wrestling match.
This is the only time, too, I actually enjoyed two commentators that weren't, like, there was not a heel commentator, there wasn't a face commentator, it was just two guys. It was, you know, Gorilla and Mean Gene actually did a really good job feeding off of each other.
Yeah, I have a few people who don't like Mean Gene as a commentator, but, you know, I feel he's a good, you know, second to Gorilla. You know, granted, you know, we all know Gorilla is like a very you know, educated soul, you know, in professional wrestling, but you know, the guy didn't have too much background on like other wrestlers as like a JR would have, but still, like, he provided, you know, enough information, you know, whether he was making it up on the fly or just, you know, running with his carotid arteries and his cervical protuberances and what have you. But in this case, you know, Mean Gene was just good enough saying whatever came to his mouth, and he didn't have too much to say, but, you know, it's just entertaining to have the dude on the mic just saying whatever the hell he's saying. Like, was that? I remember me and a friend of mine were talking about, like, did the guy even have a catchphrase when he was doing commentating? I think it was just, like, his screams.
Yeah, the give me a break. Whoa! Yeah, whoa, stuff and like, give me a break and get out of town. Yeah, he was colorful. He was a good presence.
Yeah.
You know? He was great. And again, I enjoyed it. Maybe because I'm really getting old. I'm showing my age. It's 1984 at this point. Now this thing's almost this is a long. But you know what? This card is very significant to the boom that was cable television. So All right, so he gets the win at 5 minutes and 56 seconds. Again, I just thought it was a decent match. The Sheik was always a good worker. Tony Garea still looked good, and, you know, it was good, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty decent, you know, move the card along. It was about 6 minutes.
Now.
They did their thing.
Yeah, now the next match is probably the match of the night. I think, anyway. You think? No, maybe?
I have my pick for the night. I'll get into that.
All right, myself. All right. Well, this was my pick for the night, the Intercontinental title match. Then champion, new champion, I might add, Tito Santana, versus a very new to the company, Cowboy Bob Orton. So let me paint this picture for you. This is Bob Orton without the cast, by the way, without the arm cast.
Yeah, he did not have like his broken arm for like 2 years or more at this point just yet.
Again, this was 84. Piper had just come into company also with Dr. D. David Schultz, Paul Orndorff, Junkyard Dog, Greg Valen. All these guys were coming in. This was
Oregon, Washington, and Seattle, and Mid-South guys.
This was the boom. This was Vince finally getting his claws in and taking over the territories, you know?
Absolutely.
So Santana had been champion since February 11th of 84. He defeated the original Rock, Don Morocco, for the belt.
Yeah.
Again, Orton had just rejoined the company after a successful NWA tag team title run with partner Don Knoedel, who was also tag team partners with Sergeant Slaughter for a while, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
So the match goes to a 20-minute draw. I don't have to get into it unless there's something in particular in the match that you were fond of. I don't know if...
Yeah, there was, you know, I'm not the biggest Bob Orton fan. Like, you know, he's kind of like a Bret Hart, as I like to call it. A guy who, like, depends on who he's facing will pull a great match out of him. But there was one point in this match that I thought was significant in bringing up, that Bob Orton is indeed the innovator of the Vader Bomb. He went straight to that top rope and pulled off the Vader Bomb, but, of course, you know, Santana put the knees up. But I found it interesting, you know, you see some of these moves, you know, from our heyday, like with, you know, WCW and WWF from the 80s and 90s. But it's interesting to see some of these moves being performed, you know, as early, like, as 84. Something like a friggin' Vader Bomb from Bob Orton Jr.
Yeah, well, actually, Bob Orton was the first guy I've ever seen throw a superplex.
Yeah.
Him and Barry Windham, this is me going back, I was like at least 9 or 10 years old.
That was probably a dangerous move back then.
Yeah, again, these guys didn't do a lot of the high spots. You know, it wasn't commonplace. These guys were not risk takers. There was no need for it because back then, you know, you had your set moves. Back then, you worked with the same group of guys every couple of months as you rotated through the territories, and these guys all knew each other. But the influx of guys that they had now, which this is probably the boom, the baby boom era, comparing it to the baby boom era for the WWF. Again, yeah. This was Vince taking over, bringing in guys. They brought in Studd at that time too, and Bundy and all these. So now the company's getting big, and I think this card sets the tone for the next 10 years, 12 years of the company. If, you know, if I'm wrong, then, you know, debate me on it. But
because there was like a huge shift in talent at this point. You know, I know, you know, nowadays a lot of people complain like, oh, they're firing too many people. They're hiring all these other guys. Like, you know, what's the deal? But that's exactly what was going on. You know, at this point in time, you know, there was a huge influx of new talent, you know, including your Bob Ortons, your Rowdy Pipers, Dr. D, David Schultz, all those guys. So this was a significant change, you know, in the roster. And this was, you know, just looking as far back as like a few years, everything's completely shifted. You know, they're working TV more. You know, they have shows on the USA Network, the Tuesday Night Titans. They're doing a ridiculous talk show with wrestlers running it, you know?
Within a year, that happened.
Yeah.
Because that's when I first started going to house shows around that. So it was 85 when I started going to the house shows at the Garden. Yeah. So now, you know, you hit the nail on the head, man.
Yeah.
You know,
I want to bring up one more thing.
Go ahead, man. Show too.
Because, you know, one of my favorite things about doing this and, you know, just hearing about, like, old stuff, especially if I haven't, like, seen it or not familiar with some of these wrestlers, you know, especially some of these endings, like, granted, this went to a draw, but the last thing that happens, you know, before the bell rang, just blew my mind. Just such a simple little thing that just looks so well on screen. And that was, you know, Orton was going to the, you know, to the second rope to do the fish drop onto Chico Santana. And Chico just lifts his arm up, you know, with the fist right up, and Orton's face just runs right into his fist. And he just collapses down to the mat as the bell rings. It's just such a simple and stupid little thing that you wouldn't think somebody would fall for it, but the way that it happens on screen, it's like it was meant to happen that way.
Yeah.
It's so perfect. So we'll put up a link to this, but you got to see that, like, for this match, a perfect ending to a draw. You know, granted, these kind of matches, especially back then, if a match was going to go to a draw, they would just be like going through a series of like pins. But in this case, that was not the case. It was just like this stupid little maneuver that looked so amazing on screen, and just the way it happens is so flawless.
And that's why we're partners now, buddy, because you know what? The bottom line is this is why these two guys are Hall of Famers now, 25 years later, because they told a story so well. Stuff so simple like that make it look so good. That doesn't happen anymore. And if it happens once a month, maybe twice a year, where you look at it and go, wow, you know, that looked really good. I mean, don't get me wrong, these guys are talented now on television, but it doesn't tell a story like it used to.
Yeah, okay? Once in a lifetime, twice in eternity. That's how it goes.
Pretty much. Some
of things, yeah.
All right, so your next match was Bob Backlund, of course, defeating the Butcher, Paul Vachon. Again, Vachon from the Midwest area, Canadian guy, him and his brother, the Mad Dog, the Vachon brothers, they're former AWA Tag Team Champions. Their sister Vivian was a wrestler, and he was the adopted father of their late Luna Vachon.
Yeah.
All right. How do you feel? Have you watched a lot of Bob Backlund or no?
Yeah, I really enjoy Bob Backlund because he's just like he's a really solid wrestler. And particularly for the chicken wing, and actually for this match, you know, I never really got to see too many of his matches where he used the chicken wing from back then. And I was kind of curious how it would, you know, match up to what he did when he was in the WWF in the mid-90s. And it was interesting because, you know, mid-90s, he would drag the opponent to the floor. And in this case, like, he would just have, like, you know, the arm lock from behind with the sleeper in the front. And I thought it was interesting, you know, to watch this match go down. It's super short. It's like less than 3 minutes. But, you know, it's really well played. You know, this is also, you know, Backlund's, like, not exactly his swan song, but leading up to it, because this was his last year in the WWF. I don't recall what he did after this, but, you know, once Hogan came in, you know, there were some rematches with the Iron Sheik, you know, that went down, but, you know, otherwise, you know, his spotlight, you know, dimmed significantly during this period.
Right, so they're starting to phase him out. Of course, Backlund himself, a two-time world heavyweight champion, like you stated. He had one of the longest title reigns next to Bruno until CM Punk did that also. So he's, again, the chicken wing beats the Butcher. Was a good match, I mean, for the time, you know, wasn't...
Yeah.
You know.
The Butcher wasn't, you know, the most, you know, technical wrestler for Bob Backlund, but they made it work in 3 minutes, so...
Yeah, the Butcher was one of those Midwest AWA guys that come out of the Vern Gagne camp. You know, those just rough, tough guys that they weren't even about the physique. They were just about putting the boots to you. And the Vachons were legendary for just beating people up and blooding them up at the tail end of his career at that point, too. So both guys put on a decent show for the time.
Absolutely.
All right, so now the next match was the match, as I famously call it, the match before intermission.
Yes.
It was the World Heavyweight Championship champion, then Hulk Hogan, fighting Greg the Hammer Valentine. So, Dave, you want to set this up, or you...
Yeah, I this is like, I was really happy to see this match, because it was actually, it wasn't this particular match, but their Philly fight that I think they had maybe later in the year, once Valentine had the...
IC title?
Intercontinental title, yeah.
It was the belt for belt in the Spectrum, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and this, well, as you may know, you know, a lot of these guys would face each other over and over again, having the same match. But, you know, I one of my first full-on Hogan matches was on a Coliseum, like, video. It's like the one-hour deals called Hulkamania Forever, I believe.
Right.
And it had the Spectrum match on there. And this is almost, you know, like, move for move, like, the same match. And this was really my first introduction into selling. And it blew my mind, like, you know, as a kid, you know, watching these kind of matches, specifically Hogan matches, I was on the edge of my seat for anything. But for this time in particular, Valentine was working the leg. He blatantly took the steel chair and brought it down on the knee.
Yep.
And I like the Philly match better because Hogan's selling is significantly better on there, but he's still working this, like, where he can barely walk. And it's like, oh, Hogan, get up. And that was, like, one of the beauty of, you know, getting into these kind of matches at this age, because it was like, you didn't know what the hell was going to happen.
Right.
You didn't know that these guys were doing the same match day in and day out. So, you know, it really gave some depth to Hogan. You know, I'm a huge Hogan fan, you know. I'm on par with a lot of people saying that, you know, he doesn't have much of a hold set, but, you know, still at this time, you know, he was coming out of, you know, he was still going in and out of New Japan at this point, so he could still wrestle. He was still versatile, and you could see that in this match. Like, he'll throw some power slams, he'll throw some shoulder breakers. You know, there weren't, you know, the big boots was not a setup to the leg drop just yet. It was just another move.
Right.
So
right.
This was like, you know, this was still Hogan. I would say this is Hogan in his prime. Like, he could really, he could have a really versatile match that wasn't going to be exactly like the next one. He wasn't so cookie cutter at this point. So, you know, this was a fantastic Hogan fight with Valentine. Valentine, yeah, I love Greg Valentine. The guy's like, it's like a friggin' dinosaur. You know, you can't bring this guy down.
No, he was a great worker. Couple of things I noticed. I love that, how Gorilla Monsoon calls Captain Lou the Fountain of Misinformation. I love that.
Yeah.
They always build Hogan at 305. Meanwhile, he was only like 260, 265. I love that too.
Yeah.
I'm not a big Hogan fan, you know that, but this match had a lot of action, like you said. A lot of outside the ring action.
Yeah.
Which is cool. I like that. Hogan kicks out of the figure four, not once, but twice in this match.
Oh, yeah.
And then catches Valentine with a vicious clothesline as he came from the top rope. And like you said, didn't hit the clothesline for the leg drop. After he catches him with the clothesline from the top rope, then he hits the leg drop for the win.
Yeah.
At 10 minutes and 24 seconds.
And you had Hogan come off the ropes. That was another rarity, too.
Yeah. You know, I think Hogan's one of those wrestlers that, depending on who you put, like, him and Orndorff were fantastic together.
Yeah, him actually, I would compare, you know, him against Valentine similar to him against Orndorff.
Right, and Valentine, you could put Valentine in there. Hogan had great matches with Bob Orton, too. So, I mean, it depends on who you put in the ring with him.
Yeah.
I think Hogan brings out more of his repertoire as a legit wrestler. Like, you don't have to refer to New Japan stuff. I think whoever you put him in the ring with is how you're going to get. It's what you get out of Hulk Hogan. Either way, he's
yeah.
So-
and plus, this was and plus, like you said, this was the seventh month anniversary of Hulkamania.
Yeah.
So the guy was still proving himself as champion because, you know, like we just talked about, there was like a huge shift in. You know, performers for the WWF now. So these fans were, you know, going right into Hulkamania, you know, after a 7-year stint of, you know, Bob Backlund mania, or whatever you want to call it, Howdy Doody mania. And so, yeah, this was, you know, Hogan was proving himself. Like, he had to pull it all out there. You know, his matches with Dr. D, David Schultz, you know, at this time were brutal. Like, he was blading a lot during then, and, you know, his feud with Big John Studd as well. You know, this is, you know, this wasn't your typical Hogan taking over the fight for most of the fight. And then, you know, the heel would get in his licks for a little bit, and then Hogan would return and, you know, win the match. This was like back and forth a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I enjoyed the match. So,
yeah.
And I'm not a big Hulk Hogan fan. I just, you know, again, the more I see of him fighting guys that can actually wrestle, the better I feel about watching a Hulk Hogan match.
There you go.
So, all right. So your next match. Now this is right up your alley. The WWF had a martial arts championship.
Yeah, I always thought these were like fake championships, but you know, I was doing some research on there, and there was actually a title. There was actually a belt, even though he doesn't have the belt with him, you know, at this event. But it existed. You know, usually you hear about these kind of like championships, and it's like, yeah, you know, they're just talking some bullshit. You know, the World Martial Arts Championship. The guy's not even using any karate or anything like that. It's like, how is this guy the World Martial Arts Champion? But you know, at this point in time, you know, people. Karate, you know, Karate Kid and all that kind of stuff was, you know, it was still kind of like in infancy. You know, you had your Bruce Lees, but, you know, that was more Kung Fu. And, you know, it had like its niche audience. So it wasn't like, you know, nowadays with mixed martial arts and people, you know, have a good understanding of, you know, what certain holds look like, you know, stances and all that. So, you know, hearing a mix, you know, hearing a World Martial Arts Championship, it just sounded like some bullshit that that Monsoon was just spewing out. But it was legit, and apparently even spawned a title in New Japan. I think it was called, like, the Great 18.
It was.
Which Riki Choshu held and Great Muta held until Great Muta said, you know, fuck this belt because it doesn't mean anything.
Exactly. Exactly. The belt was given to Inoki in 1978, of December of 78, and it was given to him at an MSG house show. He then had some kind of karate match and lost it in the fifth round by knockout in April of 89.
Yeah.
Won it back in May of that year, I believe, if my notes... Yeah. And, again, then you just... Could you just actually finish my next statement, which was him? They made another belt, and Muta had it, and Riki Choshu had it. So he, we all know Antonio Inoki was a god in Japan.
Yeah,
still is. And he fights.
Charlie Fulton was not.
No, Charlie Fulton was a job guy, enhancement talent. Of course, Mean Gene talking about Inoki's famous match with Muhammad Ali, which we should get into it another time. I like to see that.
There's also like a huge story to all that too. So
yeah, so we'll get into that another time. Inoki being called an artist by Monsoon and Mean Gene. Of course, Inoki was a legit, you know, karate guy and a submission guy, and this was before mixed martial arts. Of course, he applies a couple of submission holds, and he actually hits Charlie Fulton with an enziguri.
Yeah, the ghetto blaster.
Yeah, old school ghetto blaster.
Bad News Brown fans.
Yeah, man. So, all right. So now your next match was a tag team title match.
Now, this was my match of the night.
Yes, your match of the night. Oh, really? His match of the night? Good, good, good.
Yeah.
Was, of course, the adorable one. Well, before he was adorable, this was a tough New Yorker, Adrian Adonis, with the man, Dirty Dick Murdoch, versus Sergeant Slaughter and Terry Daniels. Now, Dave, what do you know about Terry Daniels?
Oh, my God. I was really interested. I wish I could have done some more research on, like, some of these, like, smaller guys, like Charlie Fulton and all them. But I looked up Terry Daniels because, you know, it was like, well, you had your what was it, Private Canoodle in the NWA, or Corporal, and, you know, now Slaughter's in the WWF, and he's got his Cobra Corps with Terry Daniels, who is like this absolutely plain-looking, the guy must be like 5'9". You know, very insignificant looking person in this match. You know, you have like this great match going on, and there's just like this one guy who just looks out of place. It's like, who's Private Terry Daniels? And apparently the guy was like a legit Marine. And how the guy got into pro wrestling was actually pretty interesting. I was reading how they used to have these kind of exhibitions with the fans, where wrestlers would legitimately call out fans to come into the ring. You know, this is pretty new to me. I never heard of this until looking up Terry Daniels. And believe it or not, it was the adorable one, well, not yet at least, Adrian Adonis, who called out Terry Daniels from the crowd. And these guys, you know, they just had like this exhibition match, you know, to see if, you know, the common man could defeat the pro wrestler. And, you know, we've all heard the stories of, you know, guys like Dr. Death and, you know, tough guys getting challenged at bars. And, you know, promoters like Bill Watts saying, like, you know, if you get challenged to a fight and you can't beat the shit out of, like, some drunk at a bar, you know, don't bother coming back to work. So, right. So you had Terry Daniels, you know, go against Adrian Adonis, and he actually was able to carry his weight during the match, and, you know, they invited him back. So, you know, this is kind of like a significant little meeting here, because Adrian Adonis is actually the guy who broke in Terry Daniels, and granted, Terry Daniels never really, you know, mounted to any bigger things than this, but an interesting backstory to all this, yeah.
Yeah, another thing, I don't know if you know this either, but Terry Daniels had a beef with the whole exhibition thing. This goes back to Southwest Championship Wrestling.
Really?
There was an incident in San Antonio, Texas, right? So, where both guys were there at the time, he was beat up by Adonis while holding the American flag.
Wasn't it the Iron Sheik?
No. This was Terry Daniels doing an exhibition. He was holding the flag with the audience and stuff, you know, doing the whole USA thing. Adonis beats him up, and the thing was, he never let the flag hit the floor.
Oh.
Like, he held onto the flag while Adonis just kicked the crap out of him. So that, like, gave him, like, that some kind of notoriety around that territory, and they brought him up north with them. And of course, Sarge at the time looking to recruit for his new Cobra Corps. again, this is right before G.I. Joe and all that stuff, so...
Yeah.
So that beat goes all the way back to Texas.
Wow.
I just want to point out a couple of things before the match. I thought Adonis and Murdoch were a great tag team.
Yeah, they were phenomenal. They were, like, for this time, like, granted, you know, a lot of these tag teams, they would probably get, like, one good run, and that was it. But, man, these guys had a hell of a run. Actually, you know, years ago I got, like, a best of from IVP of Adonis and Murdoch. And these guys were just – they gelled so well. And the fact that it was, like, a tag team of, you know, the city street tough with the fucking redneck, it was just kind of like this really odd couple being paired up, and they worked so well together.
Yeah, dude, they were great together. I thought the flow of the match, even with Terry Daniels and Sarge – yeah. I thought everybody was good. Like, again, Sodden Slaughter, in my opinion, I don't think he doesn't get the recognition at times,
yeah,
because of certain situations he put himself in terms of, I mean, not him personally, his character. I mean, he was either he was defending the flag or he was an Iraqi sympathizer. His in-ring work was pretty solid. You know, going back to the AWA and the NWA days with Don Knotel, as I mentioned before. I mean, all these guys were fantastic. Terry Daniels actually fell off after this.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I guess it's somebody has to take the fall in these companies, and I guess it's him, I guess. Whatever.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, he, you know, this was a significant change, and this was the more the showmanship and characters and personas and charisma, and, you know, he really wasn't fitting that mold.
Right. So at one point in the match, Sarge hits Dirty Dick with the Cobra Clutch. Adonis saves the belt at that point because I think Dirty Dick was about to go out.
Yeah.
Bedlam, of course, breaks outside the ring, inside the ring too. The ref doesn't see the sick classic double team on Daniels.
Yeah, and this was kind of like a demolition kind of finish, awesome. You know, like the decapitator. But yep. But instead of, like, the clothesline, he dropped the knee on him,
which I thought was fantastic, and I was, again, took the word out of my mouth. I'm so, see, what, guys, Dave is not in the Decadome tonight. He's at the power plant.
Yeah, I'm at the powers plant.
So, I'm not looking at Dave, but Dave is actually finishing almost all my sentences in my notes. This is fantastic. So,
yeah, one thing that kind of blew my mind during this match was these fans were chanting USA, and everyone in that match is from the USA. So
again, man, it was a hot time in the country, man. And you had the whole hostage thing, and that Argo thing was going on, and the Iran thing was like heavy. I mean, politically, the world was a mess. Yep. Not that it's not a mess now, but that's another podcast. That's not how Dave and I get down. We don't do politics here.
No politics here.
Only just locker room politics. Only locker room politics.
Yeah.
So they hit the devastating finisher at 17-16 of the match, which I thought was fantastic. All right, so
second longest match of the night. So.
Right, it was second longest match of the night. Of course, your next match, they had the Mean Gene. They always recorded the locker room promos for these people so the commentators can actually... Sometimes they go to the back and conduct it, depending if they were time constrained or not. Obviously, Gene makes note of that. He, you know, I recorded this earlier. It was taken out to the back. And, of course, they're interviewing then-women's champ Fabulous Moolah. Albano states that Moolah has had the title for 27 years. And, of course, Moolah does her thing.
Which I think was interesting because that's the belt that she had was something that she just created on her own.
Yeah.
Years ago. Good resource to get some more information on this is the Lipstick and Dynamite documentary that was done on, you know, Fabulous Moolah, Mae Young, yep. and a lot of those like old school female wrestlers from back then. But
if you guys have Netflix, it's on Netflix. It's a really good documentary.
Yeah. So she may have had some losses here and there, but this was like literally like her own homemade belt, which had her ugly photo on it.
And this was right before the boom again. I think this is a very significant time, dude, because Wendi Richter wins the belt tonight, but we'll get into that in a second. But this starts the Leilani Kais coming in, and the Judy Martins, and the Velvet McIntyres, and the Jumping Bomb Angels, subsequently the Sherry Martels, Rockin' Robin, who was Sam Houston and Jake Roberts' sister. You know, this match revitalizes women's wrestling. GLOW gets popular at this point, so there's a market for women's wrestling now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always prominent in the 50s and 60s, but even back to the 40s, as you stated with Lipstick and Dynamite. But now it's coming of age again.
Yeah, now it's coming to the forefront. This is the main event for the evening. And though, you know, I want to throw it out there. A lot of people would always think, like, oh, the champions were lazy, so they would have the main events in the middle of the card so Hulk Hogan can enjoy the rest of his night or whatever. But that wasn't the case. That was normally when the main events went down, middle of the card.
Right, and again, main event for me was a title match right before the intermission, because then, of course, after the intermission, you had Howard Finkel coming out announcing the next card, setting up for next month. So this was the eighth match of the evening. Not only was it the main event, but you had three more matches afterwards.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really wasn't... I'm not a big women's wrestling fan, but the significance of this match is pretty decent. Moolah was really big into throwing chicks who had long hair. Moolah was just whipping the shit out of Wendi Richter, throwing her back and forth, tossing her by her hair out of the ring. That had to hurt.
Yeah, and if anybody does check out the Lipstick and Dynamite documentary, you'll find out how like really nasty and just business minded, you know, some of these women are. You know, it's not just the guys. You know, Moolah, granted, she's like 1,000 years BC, like at this point, and she still wants her spot.
Absolutely. And can perform at that level even at that age.
Yeah.
So the finish is Moolah goes for a back suplex, but did not raise her shoulders, thinking she gets the pin, but in essence, Wendi Richter gets the pin.
Yeah, this was your kind of classic who's going to win this match kind of deal.
Yeah.
You would think that Moolah had it because, you know, she put the move on her, but Richter got the shoulder up and got the win.
Right, so Wendi Richter is your new women's champion at 11:48. The post-locker room was great. Cyndi Lauper shooting on Albano, calling him a sexist and feminist and all, you know, person and all that. And, of course, Sergeant Slaughter comes out to congratulate Wendi. Hulk Hogan comes out calling Richter the Marilyn Monroe Wrestling. I don't know about
that. Yeah, there was a very kind of a little sexual tension between the Hulkster and Wendi Richter.
Yeah, he likes that Texas Texas T over there.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, and then, of course, Albano, the heel manager, comes in trying to, you know, spoil the party, but there's a whole bunch of, you know, Dave Schultz, the real-life manager of Cindy Lauper. Dave Wolf. Yeah. Dave Wolf is the real-life manager of Cindy Lauper.
He's the husband of her, too.
What's that?
I think they were married.
I think so, too.
I know that they were romantically linked. I don't know if there was a marriage out of it. But
yeah, the whole Time After Time video when he's in a trailer and she steals his lunchbox. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I know you're an 80s guy, so
you'll
appreciate all my 80s references. I know all that shit, yeah. Man. This was Friday Night Videos time for Phil, you know?
Yeah.
On Friday nights. But,
this was like a real like hallmark of what was to come, because you know a lot of people want to say you know Hulk Hogan was the reason why you know wrestling boomed the way it did, and you know some people also want to say you know McMahon was the reason, but you know Cindy Lauper deserves a lot of credit because she was showing up at the house shows, she was making the appearances like on a regular basis. You know, and if it weren't for the fact that, you know, her record was number one in 84, you know, who's to say, you know, if Hulkamania would have really pulled, you know, pro wrestling to where it is, you know. So I'm going to be the first one. If I'm not the first one, then I'm one of however many there. I'm going to say Cyndi Lauper is a huge, if not even the reason why wrestling became as popular as it did. Because otherwise, you know... You know, granted, Hogan was in Rocky III, and that brought him a lot of attention, but, you know, the AWA didn't blow up like the WWF did. You know, it took a lot of factors, and I think Cyndi Lauper was a huge, if not, like, the big reason why things got to where it got.
And I'm glad, dude, this is fantastic that you just said that, because right before we started the cast, I posted a... I posted that we were going to be recording, and if we had any, you know, anybody had any questions or comments for the show, to put them on our Facebook page. And our buddy Mike Norenganger from Midnight Jury said that this particular call was an interesting choice of topic, and an equally interesting choice for the main event, women's match topping the card. He says, "I know the storyline with Lauper was big at the time, but really, I guess it worked ratings wise. I'm sure it would have cared more if it wasn't three or four at a time." I guess at that age, he says, "I knew who Hogan was, even versus Valentine. The world title match is supposed to be the draw, but you see, it wasn't. And that was the significance and the beauty of this particular card. This, Cyndi Lauper's presence, rocking wrestling, this started, and then it naturally progressed into Roddy Piper getting involved a few months later and starting the war to settle the score. And this, again... This was very, very, very significant. So, Mike, to answer your questions and to, you know, comment on what you said, yeah, this is – women's matches did not main event at all at this point. This was the first. And, again, Cyndi Lauper and the whole rock and wrestling connection. Cartoons came out of this. MTV had aired another card, which is February of 85. That was the water settler score again, like I said. And this was a big thing. This was a big deal. So that's why we particularly picked this card.
Yeah. So Hulk Hogan's main squeeze. Wendy Richter gets the title.
Yep.
And moves on into wrestling history.
Moves on to wrestling history. The next match is number 9, my favorite wrestler of the time at that time. This is before I fell in love with NWA. Paul Orndorff. You know how I feel about Paul Orndorff. He's my man. I love Paul Orndorff growing up. He's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time.
Mr. Number Wonderful.
Number Wonderful. That's right, baby. Tampa, Florida. The king of the pile driver. Beats a aging Chief J. Strongbow.
Yeah. One thing that I thought was really interesting about this match was I really loved how Orndorff just drawed out his taking his robe off and getting into the ring. Like, nowadays, I can really enjoy it and just, like, kick back and laugh when I see stuff like that, because really, it's the psychology at work. And Strongbow, you know, despite his body looking like a melting candle, like, he still could really, emotively, you know, express his disapproval at having to wait for this asshole to get in the ring to take off his robe.
That's what the heels did.
Orndorff did it so well.
Yep.
And I showed you that. I posted that video a while back of Paul Orndorff at the gym.
Yep, with the fat chick.
With the fat chick. And he was into that character of just that narcissistic, egotistical, like, asshole that was, like, it was done to a T at that point.
And I'm going on record in saying that he was one of the only guys I felt in my heart that should have been world champion for a little while anyway.
Yeah, I think at this time, I wish he would have gotten an Intercontinental run.
He had some matches with Santana, but it just didn't pan out for him. They never gave him a belt. Never.
Yeah.
Never. This went 3 minutes too long, I think. I love Jay Strongwell, but not for this match. Orndorff actually did not win the match at Apollo Driver. He hits a flying clothesline for the win at 6 minutes.
Yeah, it was kind of like a weird botched kind of clothesline, but still knocked the crap out of the Chief. And I wanted to mention also the Chief had some interesting feathers for this one. He had the pink.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
I was like, what's up with that? You know, he had like these neon pink, orange, like, headdress on.
Hysterical.
Yeah.
Hysterical. All right, so number 10, Afa beating Rene Goulet. Nothing significant there unless you see something I didn't.
It was your typical, you know, job match. You know, the first match started off with a Samoan, your second to last, your last singles match ends with Samoan, but, I did a little research on Rene Goulet.
Yes.
Because I've seen this guy forever.
Of course you have.
And if you haven't seen him, just look back at a lot of, like, late 80s, early 90s WWF. Again, he's one of the men in suits running out to the ring whenever there's some sort of chaos, you know, unfolding and they need to break it up, you know, along with the other old-timers like Gurria and Chief J. Strongbow would come out. And, I always thought it was interesting because, you know, especially during this time, he kind of had a Hulk Hogan look to him. Obviously, he wasn't in, like, the same kind of shape as Hogan, but he always had, like, that, like, short, balding, longish blonde hair look to him. And I was, like, wondered, like, who the hell is this guy? Like, I have friends of mine who call him Bulk Bogan because, you know, whenever he would come out to the ring, you know, to break shit up, like, it's like, who is this guy? He looks like Hogan. And then, you know, going back to this stuff, it's like, oh, he was actually a wrestler called Rene Goulet. And the guy's pretty interesting. And watching a lot of these matches, like, you'll hear, first off, you'll hear, like, Gorilla Monsoon constantly making fun of him. Like, he always makes fun of his dirty Michael Jackson ripoff glove that he would wear to the ring, you know, to do his signature hold, Le Scorpion, the claw hold. But, believe it or not, you know, besides these jobber matches, the guy actually had a WWF tag title reign with Carl Gotch.
Yes, he did.
If you can believe that. I don't think it was very long, but it was in 71. And Carl Gotch, he's glorified as the, besides Ricky Dozon, the other god of, your forefather god of pro wrestling in Japan.
Yeah, Gotch was old then.
Yeah.
You know, so Rene Goulet was the young guy. And, you know, he was one of those guys that just stayed around. And
yeah.
always had a job, and he was well-respected. I've seen him on almost every card I was at. I'd say from 85 to, like, late 86, 87, he jobbed on almost every card I was at Madison Square Garden. So,
but,
yeah, so.
Here's some little interesting facts that I pulled up on him. The guy actually got his name from Vern Gagne.
Did he really?
Yeah, and it's actually a play off of Robert Goulet's name.
Oh.
Like, if some of you guys don't know who Robert Goulet is, I know he's in one of the Naked Gun movies. Watch one of the Naked Gun movies and find out. He was, like, this Canadian kind of, like, lounge singer who, I guess he was kind of like a, he was pretty famous. But he was not quite at your, who do I want to bring up? Why am I forgetting his name? Tom... Fill in the blank for me, Phil.
Which one? Wait, what were we talking about? The Tom Zink?
No, not Tom Zink.
Richard?
The Las Vegas singer, Tom something.
Tom Jones?
Tom Jones,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
He was on the level of a Tom Jones.
Oh, all right.
Robert Goulet. But for some reason, Vern Gagne wanted to capitalize off of his popularity and, named Rene Goulet off of Robert Goulet.
Right.
But, the guy is credited also with giving Ric Flair his first loss. in pro wrestling. And he also started in the WWF the same time as Hulk Hogan in 79,
right,
along with Samoans and Ken Patera. So this guy was legit at one point in his career, but, you know, at this point in time, like, he was, you know, on the tail end, just breaking in a lot of the new guys. And that was his purpose at this point.
Yeah, so Alpha beats Rene Goulet at 343, and now Rene Goulet does double duty as he is in the 20-man Battle Royal.
Oh, one last thing. He even wrestled under the moniker of Buddy Rogers Jr.
No, he didn't. I should have looked him up. I'm glad you looked him up. I had no...
Buddy Rogers Jr. He's apparently the son of the original Nature Boy.
That's pretty funny. All right, so all right. Thank you for the extended history lesson of Rene Goulet. We all appreciated that. And I'm sitting here calling Tom Jones, Tom Zink. I'm not even thinking about that, but yeah.
Yeah.
But again, kudos to you. That was good stuff. I didn't know. I knew some of that. I didn't know. I knew the Hall Gotch thing. I didn't know about the whole Buddy. I didn't know any of that stuff. So that was cool. I didn't even bother looking that up. So thank you, sir, for picking up my slack on that.
There you go.
So of course, Mr. Goulet does double duty. He's in a 20-man battle royal. Everybody on the card that was on the card, except for maybe Valentine and Hulk Hogan, were what's that?
And the women.
And the women, were in it. And of course, you had jobbers like Jose Luis Rivera, Steve Lombardi, Samu, and let's see, who else? I read the list. There was Sika, Jose Luis Rivera, Butcher Vachon, Tony Garea, Afa, Steve Lombardi, Chief J. Strongbow, Dick Murdoch, Bob Orton, Adonis, of course, Rene Goulet, like I mentioned, Ron Shaw, Charlie Fulton, Terry Daniels, Iron Sheik, Tito Santana, Paul Orndorff, Sergeant Slaughter, and Samu. And, of course, your winner was Antonio Inoki. Of the
karate master, I mean the world martial arts champion.
Right. So he wins it by eliminating Rene Goulet.
Yeah, you know, Goulet made it all the way to the top two, but he just couldn't handle his shit when it came to Inoki. I'll say this about Inoki. I really like watching him wrestle. He always had an interesting way of handling himself in the ring. He was one of the few guys who would really... Didn't matter who he was wrestling, he would play up to whoever they were, and especially in his battle royal, he would, you know, run to the other side of the ring and just kind of like, you know, stare down his opponent. Like his stance, his posture in these matches, you know, really kind of showed that, you know, he wasn't just, you know, another guy. I'm sure a lot of people at these events are like, oh, who's this Antonio Inoki guy, you know? Some just the martial arts, even though granted he's the martial arts world heavyweight champion, but, you know, the guy really lived up to his legacy, you know, even in stuff like this, always pulled out like a fantastic performance.
I agree. We will be doing a lot more extensive coverage of Antonio Inoki as his classic matches with Ric Flair and, of course, Muhammad Ali. And, you know, Inoki still is an icon in the sport that is professional wrestling. So we're going to get into him extensively in the next couple of months, I hope, anyway.
Yeah.
And now that we have a good connection for between you and IVP and all the other outlets we have, now we get some good Japan stuff. Because, again, I think Japanese wrestling for its time, in that time anyway, was starting to come to the forefront in terms of performance. Guys went over there to prove themselves. Couple of guys went there and became legends. We already spoke about that a few months ago.
Yep.
You know, and I think, you know, they need to be those guys like Inoki, Ricky Choshu, Great Muda. You know, those guys need to be, of course, Masada and Kenta Kobashi, and you know, all those guys need to be acknowledged at some point, since we do a kick-ass throwback wrestling podcast. So
no doubt.
So all right, so that's that. That was your card. That was the brawl to end it all. July 23rd, 1984, the 29th anniversary of the card, setting up big things for the World Wrestling Federation.
And setting up the war to settle the score.
Which was February of 85, I believe. That's how much it's drawn out.
Do you think we should do that for the next episode?
You know what? No.
No?
No, we're going to hold off. We're going to hold off. And I mean, we'll let the masses speak. If the masses want to hear it, then we'll do it. If not, then we'll go with the original idea that you shot on me last night, which I think
Should we put it to a vote for the fans, my idea versus the war to settle the score?
Yeah, let's do that. And if I'll even sweeten the pot. If you guys can, whoever votes and gives us a legit explanation on why they think that should be the next episode, which is episode 32, then Dave and I will send you a kick-ass prize.
So, there you go.
Because we have a couple that left over from
all the prizes that nobody won at the anniversary.
Yeah, fucking Bowman wants a prize, and he couldn't even answer the question.
Yeah.
So, all right, Dave, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. You want to plug anything? Are you doing anything else? What's going on?
I do have some things coming up, but, right now, just going to stick with, plugging Hitting Rock Bottom, which is at hittingrockbottomshow.com. New York Asian Film Festival is already done. Actually, tonight is the last night of Japan Cuts. If you like Japanese movies, come out to Japan Society in Manhattan, 47th Street between 1st and 2nd.
I know exactly where that is. That's right by my work. All right, and where can they follow the Mega Powers on Twitter?
It's at the THE Mr. MR Powers. So the Mr. Powers.
All right, Dave. That's awesome. I'm going to hang on the line. I'm going to cut this off and thank everybody. And thank you for coming on again, as always.
Thank you for having me.
And we will be back next episode as soon as possible.
Badass.
Peace out.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
This is the Black Scorpion. And when I'm not looking for Sting, I'm listening to the Shining Wizards podcast. ShiningWizards.com. Be a mark. Buy the shirt. I'm coming for you, Sting.
Netbreaker Podcast! Netbreaker Podcast is a pro wrestling and heavy metal themed podcast. Guest interviews, wrestling headlines, and metal news while your hosts Brian and John get completely fucking shit-faced. Past guests include Eric Bischoff, Fit for an Autopsy, Power Glove, and many, many more. Join them exclusively on the Shining Wizards Wrestling Network. Netbreaker Podcast!
Big Phil here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Please check out my boys Mike and Adam, hosts of the Midnight Jury Podcast, the only podcast that transports you back to the last old school generation as they debate in detail 80s and 90s pro wrestling, horror movies, and pop culture. Before the internet, before Blu-ray, before cell phones, there was the last old school generation. So check out my boys on the Midnight Jury exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. Hey, Big Phil here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Check out two professional wrestlers, Pat Buck and Kevin Matthews, and some other guy, Jay Silva, giving insight to the wonderful yet corrupt industry of pro wrestling. Check out Two and a Half Wrestlers, the bad boys of podcasting, exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. Hey guys, Phil Raya here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Check out Pro Wrestling 101. It's a show about the ins and outs of pro wrestling, hosted by 20-year veteran of the Squared Circle, Just Incredible. Now that's not just the best, that's not just the coolest, that's Just Incredible on the Shining Wizards Network. Hey, Phil Ray here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Listen to Wrestling Soup every Thursday night, 10:15 p.m., live on WrestlingSoup.com. Anthony Missionary Thomas, Joey Numbers, best fans in the world. It's a complete shitstorm. Trust me, I know. It's got everything. It's got bitches. It's got bagels. It's got retarded women. It's got everything. Check it out. WrestlingSoup.com. Wrestling-news.com. That's right, wrestling-news.com. Those are my pals, Don, Tony, and Kevin Castle, one of the best shows on the planet,
spot on predictions, awesome commentary, and they're a bunch of cool dudes. Check them out exclusively on wrestling-news.com, live every Monday, right after Raw, 11:15. Tell them Phil sent you, and you'll get completely nothing for it. Big Phil here from the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Check out my two buds, Will Sweeney, Chris Espo, Tattoos and Touchdowns, All Football, All the Time, every Tuesday live, exclusively on RadioInfluence.com. Tattoos and Touchdowns, baby.
Alrighty then, episode 31 of the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast is in the books. SWN.ShiningWizards.com is the place. That is our network. That is our home base. Support the network and get us on iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boo. It's all there. Hit us up. Shining Wizards. SWN.ShiningWizards.com. Of course, the Shining Wizards being marked by the shirt. Listen, you want to contact our show? TBuckleTBacks is the Twitter. Facebook.com/TurnbuckleThrowbacks. You can email the show, turnbuckle throwbacks1@gmail.com. And Dave and I were serious. If you have a good rebuttal for our last episode, and if you think the water settle score should follow up the brawl to end it all, leave us your comments on the Facebook page or on Twitter, and we'll send you a cool-ass prize. I have a few of them that we didn't give away from the anniversary show, and I would love to give you a prize. All right? Other shows on the network, Neckbreaker Podcast, 2.5 Wrestlers, Pro Wrestling 101 with Justin Credible, coming soon this August, The Fallen Angels, and of course my pals, The Midnight Jury. Shout out to Adam and my buddy Mike. Guys, thank you so much for your love. Great episode. Your last episode was fantastic, by the way. And I appreciate all the love, and I will throw the love back. Support your local podcasts, guys. Support your local internet radio shows. If you're a music guy, support your local bands. Internet radio, podcasting, we're taking over. The network is doing big things. Big shows coming up in the next couple of months. Legends of the Ring in October. Hopefully a cross-promotion show with the Jury. We're going to work that out. Do some Halloween-y stuff because they're big horror buffs. Horror movie buffs, I should say. And it's going to be a fun time. All right? Guys, that's going to do it for us. And we'll be back in a week or two, hopefully. I'm glad Dave's back from his whoring and his hustle. And we're getting back to the swing of things. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other, and avoid the clap. Peace out.